This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
The birth of Gaia.
Let us return to the scientist who proposed the idea of Gaia in the late 1970s, Britain's James Lovelock. It is ironic that many environmentalists refer to Lovelock's theory of Gaia without realizing the scientist made his argument out of hostility to environmentalism. Considering the impact of it, here is a historic description by Lovelock of how this concept was born. Quote, "The chemical composition of the atmosphere bears no relation to the expectations of steady-state chemical equilibrium. The presence of methane, nitrous oxide, and even nitrogen in our present oxidizing atmosphere represents a violation of the rules of chemistry, to be measured in tens of orders of magnitude. Disequilibria on this scale suggest that the atmosphere is not merely a biological product, but more probably a biological construction. Not living, but like cat's fur, a bird's feathers, or the paper of a wasp's nest, an extension of a living system designed to maintain a chosen environment. Thus, the atmospheric concentration of gases, such as oxygen and ammonia, is found to be kept at an optimal level, from which even small departures could have disastrous consequences for life. The climate and the chemical properties of the Earth now and throughout its history seem always to have been optimal for life. For this to have happened by chance is as unlikely as to survive unscathed a drive blindfold through rush hour traffic. By now, a planet-sized entity, albeit hypothetical, had been born with properties which could not be predicted from the sum of its parts. It needed a name. Fortunately, the author William Golding was a fellow villager. Without hesitation, he recommended that this creature be called Gaia, after the Greek earth goddess, also known as G, from which the root of the sciences of geography and geology derive their names. In spite of my ignorance of the classics, the suitability of this choice was obvious. It was a real four-lettered word, and thus would forestall the creation of barbarous acronyms." End quote. Lovelock first proposed the Gaia hypothesis at a science conference in Princeton, New Jersey in 1969. By his own account, it was not well received. However, Lynn Margulis of Boston University liked it and later became a collaborator with him. Lovelock continued, "We have since defined Gaia as a complex entity involving the Earth's biosphere, atmosphere, oceans, and soil, the totality constituting a feedback or cybernetic system which seeks an optimal physical and chemical environment for life on this planet. The maintenance of relatively constant conditions by active control may be conveniently described by the term homeostasis." End quote. The Gaia hypothesis, Lovelock says, quote, "is an alternative to that pessimistic view which sees nature as a primitive force to be subdued and conquered. It is also an alternative to that equally depressing picture of our planet as a demented spaceship, forever traveling, driverless and purposeless, around an inner circle of the sun." End quote. It would chill the hearts of nuclear activists to hear Lovelock describe Earth as a collection of atomic fallout. He suggests that near the beginning of our solar system, there was a supernova event, the violent explosion of a big star. Our planet, he thinks, consists of a collection of the resulting excess radioactive dust. He says, quote, "Explosions are seldom 100% efficient. When a star ends as a supernova, the nuclear explosive material, which includes uranium and plutonium, together with large amounts of iron and other burnt-out elements, is distributed around and scattered in space, just as is the dust cloud from a hydrogen bomb test. Perhaps the strangest fact of all about our planet is that it consists largely of lumps of fallout from a star-sized hydrogen bomb. Even today, eons later, there is still enough of the unstable explosive material remaining in the Earth's crust to enable the reconstitution on a minute scale of the original event." In either case, our solar system must have been formed in close conjunction with a supernova event. There is no other credible explanation of the great quantity of exploding atoms still present on Earth. The most primitive and old-fashioned Geiger counter will indicate that we stand on fallout from a vast nuclear explosion. Within our bodies, no less than 3 million atoms rendered unstable in that event still erupt every minute, releasing a tiny fraction of the energy stored from that fierce fire of long ago. The Earth's present stock of uranium consists of only 0.72% of the dangerous isotope U-235. From this figure, it is easy to calculate that about 4 eons, 4 billion years ago, the uranium in the Earth's crust would have been nearly 15% U-235. Believe it or not, nuclear reactors have existed since long before man, and a fossil natural nuclear reactor was recently discovered in Gabon, Africa. It was in action 2 eons ago when U-235 was only a few percent. We can therefore be fairly certain that the geochemical concentration of uranium 4 eons ago could have led to spectacular displays of natural nuclear reactions. In the current fashionable denigration of technology, it is easy to forget that nuclear fission is a natural process. If something as intricate as life can assemble by accident, we need not marvel at the fission reactor, a relatively simple contraption, doing likewise. Thus, life probably began under conditions of radioactivity far more intense than those which trouble the minds of certain present-day environmentalists. Moreover, there was neither free oxygen nor ozone in the air, so that the surface of the Earth would have been exposed to the fierce, unfiltered, ultraviolet radiation of the sun. The hazards of nuclear and of ultraviolet radiation are much in mind these days, and some fear that they may destroy all life on Earth. Yet the very womb of life was flooded by the light of these fierce energies. There is no paradox here. The present dangers are real, but tend to be exaggerated. These rays are part of the natural environment, and always have been. When life was first developing, the destructive, bond-severing power of nuclear radiation may even have been beneficial, since it must have hastened the essential process of trial and error by dismantling the mistakes and regenerating the basic chemical spare parts. Above all, it would have hastened the production of random new combinations until the optimum form emerged. End quote. While earlier ages modeled their comparatively peaceful world on gods and creation myths, the scientific creature in the age of Hiroshima finds his model in the horror of man-made suns exploding in cities. It is, it seems to me, a psychological adoption of the persona of the abuser. The result of Lovelock's theory explains, even praises, the natural beauty of the atomic bomb and dangerous nuclear reactors. Note that Lovelock's idea of life is very broad. During the period of higher radioactivity he mentions, billions of years ago, there were no multicellular life forms at all. Only single-cell organisms survived in such an environment. Later, Lovelock will explain to us that if nuclear weapons were all used in a war, life would survive. We would only be missing humans and large mammals. Lovelock's whole argument was used by the apologists for the nuclear industry, including the alleged nuclear reactor in Gabon, to show that man-made nuclear reactors in cities were also perfectly natural. The book Gaia was written before the Chernobyl nuclear reactor poisoned much of Europe and the Ukraine. We will get to know more about the Gaia hypothesis in our next session.
EcoShock Radio. Broadcast and podcast. Find us on the web at ecoshock.org.